For this Monday, August 3rd, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your headlines. Top executives from more than 100 U.S. companies, including Starbucks, Microsoft, and MasterCard, calling on Congress to immediately help small businesses facing what they call economic calamity. In a letter dated today and addressed to congressional leaders of both parties, the executives painting what they call a dire picture: mass business closures as coronavirus cases continue to surge and the recession deepens. It comes as congressional leaders holding another round of talks with White House officials today, reporting slow progress but no agreement. The global death toll as a result of COVID-19 approaching 700,000, according to Johns Hopkins University. In New Jersey, the governor there announcing that all students who go to classes in person will be required to wear a mask in school buildings. Meanwhile, Major League Baseball continues to deal with this pandemic. A weekend series between the Washington Nationals and Miami Marlins was scrubbed because of players on the Marlins team with COVID-19. And now 7 players and 6 staff members from the St. Louis Cardinals have tested positive, prompting the MLB to postpone the team's upcoming 4-game series against the Detroit Tigers. And in an emotional video, a New Jersey federal judge says she is living every parent's worst nightmare. 2 weeks after her son was murdered, her husband critically injured. The story shaping Washington Today. It's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin on this Monday at the White House, and President Trump's comments regarding the Chinese-owned social media platform, the popular platform of TikTok. With more than 100 million viewers here in the U.S., the president confirming that he is open to a deal in which Microsoft or another U.S. company buys the video-sharing app, but says the government should also receive payment for clearing the purchase. Speaking to reporters at the White House, the president also confirming his conversations yesterday with the CEO of Microsoft.
Go ahead, please.
Mr. President, on TikTok, you said over the weekend that you're planning to ban it. Now that you spoke to the CEO of Microsoft after that. So could you give us an update on where you're...
We had a great conversation. He called me to see whether or not how I felt about it. And I said, look, it can't be controlled for security reasons by China. Too big, too invasive, and it can't be. And here's the deal. I don't mind if, whether it's Microsoft or somebody else, a big company, a secure company, very, very American company, buy it. It's probably easier to buy the whole thing than to buy 30% of it. Because I say, how do you do 30%? Who's going to get the name? The name is hot. The brand is hot. And who's going to get the name? How do you do that if it's owned by two different companies? So my personal opinion was you're probably better off buying the whole thing rather than buying 30% of it. I think buying 30% is complicated. And I suggested that he can go ahead. He can try. We set a date. I set a date of around September 15th, at which point it's going to be out of business in the United States. But if somebody, and whether it's Microsoft or somebody else, buys it, that'll be interesting. I did say that if you buy it, whatever the price is, that goes to whoever owns it, because I guess it's China, essentially, but more than anything else. I said a very substantial portion of that price is going to have to come into the Treasury of the United States, because we're making it possible for this deal to happen. Right now, they don't have any rights unless we give it to them. So if we're going to give them the rights, then it has to come into this country. It's a little bit like the landlord-tenant. Without a lease, the tenant has nothing. So they pay what's called key money, or they pay something. But the United States should be reimbursed or should be paid a substantial amount of money, because without the United States, they don't have anything, at least having to do with the 30%. So I told him that. I think we're going to have maybe a deal is going to be made. It's a great asset. It's a great asset, but it's not a great asset in the United States unless they have the approval of the United States. So it'll close down on September 15th unless Microsoft or somebody else is able to buy it and work out a deal, an appropriate deal, so the Treasury of the, really the Treasury, I guess you would say, of the United States gets a lot of money, a lot of money.
That announcement from the president earlier today in the Oval Office. By the way, Microsoft says it is interested in buying TikTok operations in the U.S., Canada, New Zealand, and Australia, leaving other parts of the business in Chinese ownership. Now to Capitol Hill, Democratic leaders say they are making slow progress with White House negotiators after meeting for nearly 2 hours in Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office. But TheHill.com is reporting that at this rate, no deal is expected before the end of this week. Millions of unemployed Americans seeing that $600 a week unemployment benefit expire last week. After meeting with the Treasury Secretary and the White House Chief of Staff, this update from Speaker Pelosi and the Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer.
Good afternoon, everyone. We just finished a two-hour meeting with Secretary Mnuchin and Chief of Staff Meadows. It was productive. We're moving down the track. We still have our differences. We are trying to have a clearer understanding of what the needs are. And the needs are this, that millions of children in our country are food insecure. Millions of people in our country are concerned about being evicted. Tens of millions of people are unemployment insurance. The way we can correct so much of that is for us to defeat the virus. And so much of our discussion has to be on how we defeat the virus, and that takes dollars and policy. And I think that we've had good sessions of understanding where we need to go, as the leader says all the time, understanding the gravity of the situation. The virus is the villain. We can open our economy, we can open our schools, but we can only do it if our children and our families are safe. And opening their schools is a place where we spent a good deal of time. Mr. Leader?
Yeah. Again, we are really getting an understanding of each side's position. And we're making some progress on certain issues, moving closer together. There are a lot of issues that are still outstanding, but I think there is a desire to get something done as soon as we can. And so we continue to work. The staffs will be working. What we did today, to give you a little flavor of it, is we went through the numbers in the proposal that the Senate put in and the proposal that we have. How many children can you feed with this amount of dollars? For how long? How many schools can you protect for this amount of dollars so that they can open up when? And, you know, our proposals obviously are a lot more generous than theirs, and that's because, as the Speaker said, this is the greatest problem we have faced in 100 years on the health front, the greatest problem we've faced in 75 years on the economic front, and we think we need a much fuller, stronger response by the federal government to get out of this mess and to get out of this serious crisis. If we don't have that response, it'll take longer. More people will stay unemployed for a longer period of time, more businesses will close, et cetera. So, but by going through these specific numbers and what each side thinks they can do with their dollar allocation, it really helps us understand that and move together in a better direction. And that's what we spend time doing. Thank you.
You want to go? Yep. Thank you. Any progress on unemployment?
Congressional reporters with questions to Speaker Pelosi and Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer. Of course, the issue is the price tag, a Republican proposal put forth last week by Senator Mitch McConnell, totaling about $1 trillion, a Democratic proposal that passed in the House earlier this year, totaling $3 trillion. As mentioned, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, they are leading the talks for the White House, and the president was asked why he is not in the room for these negotiations.
Are you not involved directly in negotiations with Capitol Hill?
I am. Oh, the fact that I'm not over there with Crazy Nancy? No, I'm totally involved. And we're going to be doing some things that are very good because we don't think that she... Look, what Chuck Schumer wants more than anybody, and I would say Nancy Pelosi would be second, they want to bail out cities and states that have done a bad job over a long period of time. Nothing to do with coronavirus or China virus or whatever you want to call it. They want to bail out cities and states. They want bailout money. They want $1 trillion in bailout money. And a lot of people don't want to do that because we don't think it's right. The Democrats have run some very bad states and some very, very bad cities. And a lot of people don't want to give them $1 trillion to reward them for doing a bad job. If you look at some of the states, I won't insult anybody by naming those states, but you know what they are. They want bailout money. They're not interested in the people. They're not interested in unemployment. They're not interested in evictions, which is a big deal, the evictions. They want to evict. A lot of people are going to be evicted. But I'm going to stop it because I'll do it myself if I have to. I have a lot of powers with respect to executive orders. And we're looking at that very seriously right now. But what the Democrats want, they want it, they're slow rolling it. And all they're really interested in is bailout money to bail out radical left governors and radical left mayors, like in Portland and places that are so badly run, Chicago, New York City. You see what's going on over there? Bail out cities and states who have been poorly run and spent a fortune doing it. They want $1 trillion. And we're really not interested in that.
And the Washington Post, by the way, is expanding on what the president just said. He is looking at actions he can take on his own, perhaps executive actions, if the new coronavirus relief measures cannot be reached any sort of agreement with members of Congress.
It's one really big sale at Lord & Taylor. Just follow these simple steps.
And now Lord & Taylor preparing to close its doors. Known for its upscale fashions and holiday window displays, the department store, which first opened back in 1826, founded by Samuel Lord and George Washington Taylor, both from England. Andrew Scurria is covering that story for the Wall Street Journal, and we spoke to him late this afternoon.
Yesterday, Lord & Taylor filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection and said that it would liquidate and begin going out of business sales at all 38 of its department store locations. So barring a unforeseen development or a white knight investor, it means the end of the road for the store's brick and mortar presence.
And this is one of America's oldest department stores.
That's correct. And it's the latest in a string of venerable department store chains that were having financial difficulties before the coronavirus pandemic and just weren't able to outlast the drop off in revenue that occurred once governments around the country effectively banned non-essential shopping and took consumers out of malls nationwide.
And so while some companies file for bankruptcy to restructure, Lord & Taylor essentially is closing its doors.
That's correct. So some other large department store chains, such as JCPenney and Neiman Marcus, that have a bit larger footprint and a more solid financial base, are using the Chapter 11 process to shed debt, get rid of some stores, and they hope emerge from bankruptcy as, you know, stronger, leaner companies. For some, such as Lord & Taylor, it simply means the end of the road for their store presence. Now, they even stores that are liquidating, it can sometimes still sell off their intellectual property, their e-commerce operations. So shoppers could still find Lord & Taylor products online potentially after this process, but they won't be able to go into a store.
As you point out in your story, this is affecting so far this year more than two dozen companies, retailers, both large and small. What is it going to mean for shopping malls and for American consumers?
It means that a huge number of big boxes in malls, strip malls, and suburban locations throughout the country are going to get dumped on the market. And it's not really clear how all that space is going to be filled. Oftentimes, some of these establishments going out of business are anchor locations in small strip malls that help drive a lot of traffic to smaller establishments. And oftentimes when they leave, it triggers provisions in the smaller establishments' leases that make it easier for them to pull up stakes as well. So it's causing a great deal of upheaval in the commercial real estate market. And it's still, you know, yet to be determined exactly how long that will go on and how deep the pain will be.
The Wall Street Journal headline, a once grand department store, Lord & Taylor, filing for bankruptcy, and the reporting of Andrew Scurria. He is deputy editor and reporter for The Wall Street Journal. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow gaining 236 points. The Nasdaq rose 157. The S&P up 23.5. The president today firing the chair of the Tennessee Valley Authority, the TVA, criticizing the federally owned corporation for hiring foreign workers. President Trump telling reporters at the White House that he was formally removing the chair, Skip Thompson, and another member of the board, and he threatened to remove other board members if they continue to hire foreign labor. By the way, Thompson was appointed by President Trump. As background, the TVA is a federally owned corporation created back in 1933 to provide flood control, electricity, and economic development to the Tennessee Valley. Valley. That was a region that was hit especially hard during the Great Depression. It covers not only most of Tennessee, but also parts of Alabama, Mississippi, and Kentucky, as well as small sections of Georgia, North Carolina, and even parts of Virginia. The president is also calling on the CEO to be fired, claiming his $8 million a year salary should be closer to $500,000.
I am formally removing the chairman of the board, James Thompson, and board member Richard Howarth. If the TVA does not move swiftly to reverse their decision to rehire their workers, then more board members will be removed. We have the absolute right to remove board members, and the board makes the decision. I don't make the decision. I saw there was an ad on television talking about the amount of money that the chairman makes, and it's a ridiculous amount of money. But we have the right to replace the board, and the board is the one, the only ones that get the right to then hire a new person. Furthermore, the board must immediately hire that new CEO who puts the interests of American workers first. The current CEO, Jeff Liesch, is ridiculously overpaid. He earns $8 million a year. Did you know that? $8 million. He's the highest paid government official of any country anywhere in the world. Now, I don't know that you call him officially a government. It might be a public-private. It may be something. It's a long time ago it was established, the Tennessee Valley Authority. But he gets $8 million a year. So that was just a succession of deep swamp things happening, and it's a disgrace. But he gets $8 million per year, and I can think of about almost 100% of the people I know would take that job. And it's not a very hard job. I mean, you have not a lot of debt, not a lot of anything, right? Public service is just that. Those who take these jobs must be focused on the public good, not on personal profit. He would have taken the job for millions and millions of dollars less, but nobody asked him to do that. Okay, he would have gone for less. You could have had him for $4 million, $6 million, $7 million, $2 million, $1 million, probably $500,000 a year. But the new CEO must be paid no more than $500,000 a year, which is still a significant amount, more than the President of the United States makes.
That from the president on the Tennessee Valley Authority, again, which was first organized back in 1933 at the start of the FDR administration. Well, the president today publicly criticizing Dr. Deborah Birx, who was coordinating the White House coronavirus response. On Twitter, he wrote the following, quote, "So crazy Nancy Pelosi said horrible things about Dr. Deborah Birx, going after her because she was too positive on the very good job we are doing in combating the China virus, including vaccines and therapeutics." He went on to say, "In order to counter Nancy, Deborah took the bait and hit us. Pathetic." Well, that tweet following comments by Dr. Birx over the weekend, in which she delivered a sober warning on the current threat posed by coronavirus. On CNN, she said that the U.S. has entered what she called a new phase in its battle against the virus, calling it extraordinarily widespread. Meanwhile, the head of the World Health Organization indicating that there may never be what he calls a silver bullet for stopping the spread of coronavirus. Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus is urging all countries and individuals to do it all: testing, contact tracing, social distancing, and wearing masks. The total number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 has surpassed 18 million globally. We learned today that Australia is ordering non-essential businesses in Melbourne, its second largest city, to close for 6 weeks beginning Wednesday, as authorities there try to control another outbreak that accounts for nearly all of that country's new cases. More from the WHO in Geneva, Switzerland.
A number of vaccines are now in phase 3 clinical trials, and we all hope to have a number of effective vaccines that can help prevent people from infection. However, there is no silver bullet at the moment, and there might never be. For now, stopping outbreaks comes down to the basics of public health and disease control: testing, isolating and treating patients, and tracing and quarantining their contacts. Do it all. Inform, empower, and listen to communities. Do it all. For individuals, it's about keeping physical distance, wearing a mask, cleaning hands regularly, and coughing safely away from others. Do it all. The message to people and governments is clear: do it all. And when it's under control, keep going.
That from Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus. He is the Director General of the World Health Organization. The update from Geneva, Switzerland. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today for this Monday, August the 3rd. Here are some of your other headlines in New York. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office is hinting that its subpoena for the president's tax returns is part of an investigation into possibly extensive and protracted criminal conduct by the Trump Organization, including potential fraud allegations detailed in a number of recent media reports. The New York County prosecutor is indicating that the president's financial history will provide some justification for requesting the extensive amount of information as part of its grand jury investigation into the Trump Organization. Meanwhile, the Trump campaign back on the air with ads in key battleground states. And just ahead, a preview of what to expect at the Democratic National Convention in Milwaukee, which, by the way, gets underway 2 weeks from today. Now to the tropical storm as it continues to make its way up the Atlantic coast. Isaias is a storm that is now hitting Georgia and South Carolina. Shelters in North Carolina are open as well, with social distancing and protective equipment as states deal with the weather and with COVID-19. And the National Weather Service is warning that the storm could strengthen overnight. From Raleigh, North Carolina, here's Governor Roy Cooper.
I've declared a state of emergency, and we have received a federal emergency declaration for 25 counties so far. We in North Carolina mostly know what to do. You pack your emergency kit, follow local evacuation orders, stay in a safe place, and never drive through flooded roadways. But this time, pack your masks and hand sanitizer in your kit and remember to social distance. The three W's, wash, wear, and wait, are just as important during a storm as they ever were. The COVID-19 pandemic remains a threat, and preparations may take longer and look a little different. We can stay safe from the storm and the virus if we're ready. We're watching the forecast carefully and know the storm will impact much of our Piedmont and coastal plain. Tropical storm force winds are expected to begin after dark Monday and into Tuesday morning. Sustained tropical storm force winds are forecast for much of the eastern third of the state, with gusts of 50 to 65 miles per hour for the coastal plain and 30 to 45 miles per hour in central North Carolina. That's enough wind to bring down trees and power lines. Over the weekend, the storm turned much more inland, which increases the threat of heavy rain, tornadoes, and flash flooding in eastern North Carolina.
That update from Governor Cooper in North Carolina and WRAL in Raleigh reporting that more than 70 North Carolina counties now under alert for tornado watch and storm surges expected to hit, as you heard just a moment ago, overnight and into tomorrow. And now to the story of that federal judge whose son was killed and whose husband was shot at their New Jersey home last month, calling for greater privacy protections for judges. Her first comments since the tragic shooting. In a video posted on YouTube, U.S. District Court Judge Esther Salas saying that the gunman came to her home too easily, obtaining her personal information, including the address. Her emotional comments come 2 weeks after a man wearing a FedEx uniform opened fire at her home in North Brunswick, New Jersey. The gunman was a men's rights attorney who had argued a case before Judge Salas. He killed her only child, the couple's 20-year-old son, Daniel, critically wounding her husband. Her remarks run about 9 minutes. Here is a portion.
Well, my husband is still in the hospital, recovering from his multiple surgeries. We are living every parent's worst nightmare, making preparations to bury our only child, Daniel. My family has experienced a pain that no one should ever have to endure. And I am here asking everyone to help me ensure that no one ever has to experience this kind of pain. We may not be able to stop something like this from happening again, but we can make it hard for those who target us to track us down.
The emotional comments of Judge Esther Salas on the death of her son at the hands of a gunman who later killed himself. In Nevada, the legislature there has passed a bill extending mail-in ballot provisions for the November general election because of concerns over coronavirus. The bill passing out of the Assembly on Friday along a party-line vote and voted out of the Senate yesterday morning. No Republicans supporting the measure in either chamber. The bill would send about $3 million to the Secretary of State's office for the rollout of mail-in ballots. Though the bill does vastly expand the mail-in ballot provisions, it does not do away with in-person voting locations. For example, it does require in-person voting in large population centers. Clark County includes Las Vegas, and the county must have at least 100 in-person voting sites. This is from the Senate's Democratic leader, Nicole Canizzaro.
Earlier this year, there was a primary election that took place, and that election was done by mail-in vote. I myself cast a mail-in ballot for that election and was able to fill it out and put it in the mail and have my vote counted to exercise that constitutional right. We should be doing everything we can to allow people to vote and to vote safely. And what this bill absolutely is not, is an opportunity to create fraud in our elections or to allow for ballot harvesting. That is not what this bill is. We did hear testimony on this bill about there being rejected ballots. We also heard that there were no cases of voter fraud as a result of the all-mail-in primary election. It was a successful election where many people were safely able to cast their vote without risking the very, very real realities of a pandemic. I think the idea that there are rejected ballots actually flies and supports the idea that this election is secure and that this is not an opportunity for fraud. That these ballots are being taken seriously and that when a signature does not match, it is asked to be confirmed by the voter. And if we cannot have faith in that ballot, then it is not counted. That is exactly what we should be asking for. And if it was a good enough process for the primary, Madam President, it should be a good enough process for the general election, because what we have not done is mitigate the concerns of the pandemic and create a place where people can safely wait in line and show up in person and be around other people.
From Carson City, Nevada, yesterday with Nicole Canizzaro. She is the Senate's Democratic leader in the Nevada State Senate. Keith Pickard is a Republican state senator.
So the reality is we don't know if there's any evidence of voter fraud in the past because it's never been discovered in a law enforcement investigation, because those don't occur. This idea that we are disenfranchising anyone is a canard. We have absentee voting accessible every day. At any time during the year, someone can request their ballot. And I voted from outside the country. I spent a couple years in Japan, and I voted from Japan. I know what that's like. And I, because I've lived overseas in a friendly environment, I know how valuable our freedoms here are. So this idea that we need to encourage by allowing those that would threaten the integrity of our votes simply because the politics looks good is just offensive to me. We need to uphold the Constitution. We need to defend the Constitution and the integrity of our votes. Because if we don't defend that most fundamental element of our democracy, then the rest of it loses its foundation and crumbles.
And the president, following up in the comments of the Nevada State Senator, a Republican, on Twitter earlier today, at Real Donald Trump, he wrote the following, quote, "In an illegal late-night coup, Nevada's clubhouse governor made it impossible for Republicans to win the state. The post office could never handle the traffic of mail-in votes without preparation, using COVID to steal the state. see you in court. And Ronna McDaniel, who is the chair of the Republican National Committee, tweeting that Democrats were looking to, quote, create more opportunities for fraud and allow ballot harvesting. Well, as the president continues to struggle in the Real Clear average of polling across the country, his campaign today launching a new line of attack against Democratic candidate, presumptive nominee Joe Biden, calling the former vice president a tool of the radical left, someone Americans should fear. This is what the ad sounds like.
Joe Biden has embraced the policies of the radical left. Trillions in new taxes, crushing middle-class families.
If you elect me, your taxes are going to be raised, not cut.
Amnesty for 11 million illegal immigrants.
Citizenship for 11 million undocumented folks.
Reducing police funding.
Yes. Absolutely.
The radical left has taken over Joe Biden and the Democratic Party. Don't let them take over America.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
That from the Trump campaign, and earlier today, we talked to a key Democratic strategist regarding the upcoming DNC convention in Milwaukee. Here is that conversation recorded on Zoom.
Stephanie Cutter is the chief program executive for the Democratic National Convention. At what point during this pandemic did you realize you were switching from a more normal convention to one that's going to be much more virtual?
Well, we were hopeful as the pandemic was unfolding in the early months of this year, we were hopeful by moving our dates back by a month that we could still hold a physical convention where delegates could come to Milwaukee and we could conduct our party business, but also produce a traditional convention. It was pretty soon after that, as the lockdown continued, that it was clear that that wasn't going to happen. So we started planning for a convention that is fairly unconventional compared to years past pretty early. And it's taken a while to figure out exactly what it will be and how we handle ensuring that delegates can feel like they can participate, but then all Americans can feel like they can participate in this, because the benefit, there are lots of downsides. You know, we are not physically together. But the upside is more Americans can participate. You don't need a credential to participate in this convention.
But clearly, these are uncharted waters. No party has ever gone through something quite like this.
No, never. but, you know, we've been looking at lots of the other programming that's been airing over the past many months. Where people can't physically travel to do interviews or to put segments together. You know, the Global Citizens concert that aired, or the NFL draft, or, you know, the graduation ceremonies. And we've been looking at how people have been producing these and studying how best to produce content in a program like this, because it's basically a TV show. So how do we keep people engaged? How do we pull people in? And how do we communicate with people wherever they are on the platforms that they prefer? So we've been doing a lot of that work, and I feel like we're in a good place and almost ready to roll.
I realize it is a work in progress, but based on what you know now, 2 weeks before the convention gets underway, how will each night unfold?
Well, it is a work in progress, Steve, and a lot of those details are still coming together, so I don't want to make news on that right now, but it'll be 4 nights, 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. I almost got the time wrong, 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Each night, and, you know, we've got some surprises in store, and I guess what I'll say is that since this format is unconventional, we're throwing out all the rules of how conventions are programmed. And we're doing some unconventional things. So without revealing too much, I really encourage everybody to tune in. You'll see some familiar faces, President Obama and Michelle Obama, obviously Vice President Biden and Dr. Biden, and some unfamiliar faces. So we're really looking forward to it. We think it represents the diversity of America, the strength of America, and how we can pull this country together to move it forward.
And of course, we've all become accustomed to Zoom and Google Hangouts, but how do you prepare technically for this kind of convention, and what type of backups do you have to make sure that it goes smoothly?
Well, it's a mix of live segments as well as pre-recorded segments and some video production. So for the live segments for some of our biggest newsmakers, we want to make sure that they're live and unedited. So our production team is working hard. We've got, when we say this is a virtual convention, it's not technically a total virtual convention because there is enough live programming in there. But we've got backup plans in place in case something should happen. It'll be a program that moves quickly and it's very engaging.
What has been your biggest challenge, you personally?
The getting people to make the transition to it's a non-physical convention. It's totally, online and on air. And how to figure out how to get people engaged in it. And I think we've figured it out. There will be elements where people who don't normally participate in these conventions will be able to engage. There will be activities all over the country happening at the same time. So it's a mix of organizing, it's a mix of virtual content, and it's a mix of creativity. So, my biggest challenge was really, getting everybody to make that transition and thinking alike on it. But it's been a great process, a great team, lots of creativity.
Stephanie Cutter, what was your first National Party convention? Do you remember the moment?
Well, I don't want to date myself, Steve. 1988. I was an intern my freshman year in college for Michael Dukakis.
So I ask you that because I'm wondering if this is going to change conventions moving forward in 2024 or 2028.
Well, I think everybody would agree that the conventions needed to be updated. It needed to be modernized. Conventions in history were about delegates coming to vote on the nominee, and there was an element of suspense on it. And deal making and trading of votes and, out would come the nominee from this convention. It's largely a foregone conclusion now. There was a little suspense in 2016 of how that would go. There's no suspense this time, but a lot of important things that need to be said. I think it would be wise for conventions to rethink what the purpose of them are. There's party business that has to happen. But how you communicate with the American people out of them is really important. And standing on a stage with a room full of people, it is one way. But another way is to go where people are and communicate on the platforms that they care about. Conventions are really expensive. There might be a better way to spend those dollars.
As you know, C-SPAN will have live gavel-to-gavel coverage of all of the proceedings. The final night, the night that the Democratic nominee, Vice President Biden, accepts the nomination, from your standpoint right now, what's that going to look like?
Well, right now we intend for the Vice President to accept his nomination in Milwaukee. And that's where the anchor of the program will be. It'll be... it'll be a great night. One thing that is clear that people are looking to know more about Joe Biden and his life story, his record, and who he is. And they will come away from this convention knowing that.
Stephanie Cutter is the chief program executive for the Democratic National Convention, joining us via Zoom here in Washington. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And of course, the question remains, who will be Vice President Biden's running mate in campaign 2020? We expect to learn next week, according to a number of media reports. And during an event today sponsored by the Council on Foreign Relations, South Carolina Democratic Congressman Jim Clyburn, who is a key advisor to Joe Biden, weighing in on the VP pick.
We will take our next question from John Austin.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much, Congressman Clyburn. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, sir. So I just want a little clarity in your comment when you said that, if I understood you correctly, that Vice President Biden should be informed by the polling for his running mate. At the same time, he should make that decision based on his head and his heart. What I'm a little confused is, why should polling influence that decision if it's such a personal decision with a person that has to work with him in the administration? Or did I misunderstand what you said?
No, you understood me perfectly well. Look, there are a lot of people that I get along personally with, may feel good personally about. But that doesn't mean that something will not show up in the vetting. Remember, I said vetting and polling. And polling to me also include focus groups. If you are looking for people to vote for you, then I think you it's incumbent upon you to try to get people who the constituents or the voters feel creditable about. So I said that let your voting, your vetting take place, let your polling take place, and when that is over, then you then look at that and let your heart and your head then look at it. That's not the polling is not final. Your head and your heart are final. So, but I think you would be a bit foolish not to take a look at the veteran. If you don't pay attention to the veteran, stuff jumps out that you would never know anything about. And the same thing goes with polling. If you like somebody and you find that they're polling at 2%, because people that you look want to vote for you may not like the person, I think you need to take a look at that. No, you heard me perfectly well.
That insight from Jim Clyburn. He is the House Democratic Whip and played a key role in the South Carolina primary, a turning point for Joe Biden in his campaign. And again, this reminder, we'll have live coverage of the Democratic Convention and the events in Charlotte, North Carolina for the Republican Convention, which details still are TBD for the Republicans. We'll have it all for you here as part of C-SPAN's Campaign 2020 coverage. This program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast at cspan.org/podcast. And on Twitter, be sure to follow us at C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully in Washington. Enjoy the rest of your evening.